78 minutes of animation, 83 minutes with credits. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs cost almost $1.5 million, one of the highest budgets in film at the time. Today, that would be around $25 million, which wouldn't even cover some stars' salaries. A week after it was in the can, Disney arranged a special screening in Pomona, California, far enough away from Hollywood no one would know if it bombed. There was little time and no resources to fix anything that didn't work, but Walt had to know what an audience would think. The screening was at 9 p.m. Right before 10 p.m., as the climax approached, a good portion of the audience got up and walked out. Mass exoduses are never a good sign. It turned out they were college students with a curfew. But tell that to Walt's heart attack. He started to believe the bad press that Snow White was a million-dollar turkey. More bad news arrived on December 1st. Mickey had been banned in Yugoslavia. Floyd Gottfredson was doing a Prisoner of Zenda riff in the Mickey strip, and Yugoslavia was in a similar situation. Its young prince sided with the West, but the country's regent was a Nazi supporter. The Mickey story was taken as political criticism and banned. The reporter who broke the news was also exiled. Disney would survive Mickey not running in Belgrade newspapers, but it was a bad portent. Snow White's premiere had to be big. 6 months in advance, RKO and Disney made a behind-the-scenes promotional film. In the weeks before opening night, RKO plastered Los Angeles with more paper than Harry Chandler's Los Angeles Times. Walt even brought the movie's voice cast to Edgar Bergen's radio studio, where ventriloquist dummy Charlie McCarthy chatted with the Seven Dwarfs. The premiere was set for the 1,500-seat Carthay Circle Theater, the same place where the Skeleton Dance debuted way back when. The night of, Walt dressed in white tie and pocket square, which matched his short winter scarf and ever-present cigarette. Lily wore a Cartier bracelet with 8 hand-painted charms of Snow and the Seven. The night turned out to be so cold, Snow White was almost welcomed by actual snow. Thousands of star watchers watched from bleachers, among them the animators who didn't have tickets for the premiere. Clarence Nash performed a comedy bit where Donald Duck was stiffed out of a ticket. A replica dwarf cottage sat on nearby Wilshire Boulevard, next to sinister trees with long, spindly arms. 7 short actors were hired to play Grumpy, Sleepy, and others. These actors would meet angry, molesting trees again 2 years later when they filmed The Wizard of Oz. Walt called in Hollywood favors to make sure the stars came out. Did they ever? Judy Garland, Clark Gable, Elsa Lanchester, Ed Sullivan, Jack Benny, George Burns, and Gracie Allen. Tickets were $5.50, about $90 nowadays, and sold out quickly. For almost everyone who worked on the film, it would be their first time seeing the finished product, and maybe their first time seeing Walt Disney in person. The night of the show, Ink Girls and In-Betweeners hobnobbed with celebs who mostly groused about being roped into attending a stupid cartoon premiere. There were no complaints from the biggest movie star in attendance, though. Miss Shirley Temple was thrilled. As with Mickey, she was biggest in star wattage, not height. The night was made by 3 actors making their first red carpet appearance, Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, and Donald Duck. Their costumed look was a cross between modern dancer and bank robber, a far cry from the large-headed mascots familiar from theme parks. The mice's faces were painted on bags worn over their heads, and both Minnie and Mickey were rather obviously being portrayed by women in tight black bodysuits. Both also suffered from strabismus, since their pie eyes faced in different directions. Donald looked by far the best. He had a pudgy white belly, a silk tailor shirt, and a surprisingly good mask, complete with an accurate bill and huge eyes. They strolled paw and wing down the red carpet, holding hands out of camaraderie, and because the masks had no eye holes. Once inside the movie palace, guests were serenaded by a full orchestra, including the same choir used for the soundtrack. The female ushers were all dressed as Snow White. Adriana Caselotti and Harry Stockwell, the singing voices of Snow White and Prince Charming, were accidentally barred from entry and had to sneak in. Walt was a nervous chatterbox. He made self-deprecating jokes, forgot the names of some dwarfs, and said that Lily would have to hold his hand the whole time. Right when the showman aspect of Walt's personality was needed most, he became a shrinking violet. "I hope they aren't too disappointed," he said. "Not exactly P.T. Barnum." His thoughts, for some reason, went to a man he once met on a train. Walt had impressed him by saying he worked in Hollywood. Then he said he made cartoons. The traveler was repulsed. That was how real America felt, and real Hollywood, too. In 83 minutes, Walt knew his world would collapse on him. Finally, it was showtime. For the animators, the words appearing in the first minute were a highlight. "My sincere appreciation to the members of my staff whose loyalty and creative endeavor made possible this production. Walt Disney." It wasn't payback, but right then it was all they wanted. Following that came dozens of names of artists. For many, it was the first time their names had ever been on screen. Over half a century of retellings have added some oomph to how well that first audience responded to the cartoon. Did they really applaud the meticulous backgrounds? A particularly bravura feat of animation? A gag? Was the biggest laugh really Dopey hanging from the chandelier? Did the viewers cry as well? Did anyone know that what they were watching would still be popular a century later? After the show, Walt hopped on stage to a bellwether of applause from the likes of people who did not offer it easily. He was 37 years old. He and 750 friends had just debuted the most complicated piece of art in world history. They had just barely pulled it off. And now, validation. The man who addressed the rapt crowd wasn't a movie maker, nor a director or a leader. He was just a Kansas City boy who grew up watching movies and wanted to be part of it. "I always dreamed that one day I would attend a gala premiere in Hollywood of one of my cartoons," Walt said. "Tonight, you've made it come true. You've made me feel like one of you." True love's kiss in 8 plain words. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs stayed at the Carthay Circle for 4 months. A Spanish-language version was added in February. Snow White had already been booked at Radio City Music Hall, where it broke the unofficial 3 weeks and out rule by playing for over a month. Once word got out that Snow had made Hollywood laugh and cry and cheer, every theater wanted a print. Someday, their prints would come. A critics list from the New York Times of the year's 10 best movies was 10 Snow Whites. Snow White became America's favorite rewatch. You could take in half a dozen screenings and not catch every nuanced expression, every squirreled away squirrel. A quarter at a time, 10 cents for kids, Snow White earned over $8.5 million. It's still one of the all-time box office hits. Before year's end, Walt would grace the cover of Time magazine, displaying toys of the Seven Dwarfs. "The boss is no more a cartoonist than Whistler," the cover proclaimed. The first day of 1938, Snow White ushered in Pasadena's Tournament of Roses parade. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs would become a Sunday comic strip staple, receive a narrated version for the blind, and be screened by England's real-life princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret. How could Disney top Snow White? Walt dreamed of yearly features and had set the bar for success at a near-orbital height. Could he make as good a movie every year? Could it become as easy as cranking out Mickey Mouse shorts? Post-Snow, many animation companies were wrecked on the shoals of attempting to make a feature. Only one such film was ever completed, the Fleischer Brothers' Gulliver Travels. "We can do better than that with our second-string animators," Walt sniffed, and indeed they had. 1934's Gulliver Mickey. The only studio that seemed not to tackle a feature was UB Iwerks's, Iwerks did not have a good 1937. His animation studio had to accept subcontracted work from Columbia's Charles Mintz. Mintz ran a silly symphony knockoff called Color Rhapsodies and needed fast hands who worked cheap. Iwerks received director credit, a holdover from the days when his name meant something. But Mintz had been bitten by the quality bug, pouring more into each cartoon than he was getting paid for. He even got an Oscar nomination for one of his cartoons, The Little Match Girl. None of Iwerks' cartoons for Mintz were Oscar nominated, nor should they have. Skeleton Frolic is an almost shot-for-shot color remake of The Skeleton Dance. Merry Mannequins is a character light, things come alive at night piece. Nell's Yells was a weak western. What used to be Iwerks' passion was now a dead-end job. Even phoning it in, though, Iwerks found moments of transcendence. A flying pinball machine is as geometrically solid as a computer-generated image. A horse seen through funhouse mirrors is technically perfect. Ub kept trying to clap with one hand, Chuck Jones said years later. He was a mechanical genius with hardly any comic timing, a brilliant executor of other people's notions, but an unoriginal idea man. Different paths had led Walt and Ub to the same fate. Nothing they worked on again would ever be as good as what they had made before. But let that be a quandary for 1938. The year 1937 ended with a curtain call and a standing ovation. Walt Disney would never in his life see a success on the likes of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, nor would he ever stop trying to regain that night at the Carthay Circle, where the world both learned of and gave its creator a Disney ending. Chapter 30 Shoveling, 1938. Not everyone fell in love with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Caricaturist Al Hirschfeld of the New York Times much preferred the original recipe fairy tale to Disney's take and wanted Walt to return to his first success. Mickey Mouse is great art and not a clever novelty, and Disney should not underestimate the genius of its original invention, Hirschfeld said in one of Snow's few negative reviews. In time, the art world would start to scour Hirschfeld drawings for his daughter Nina's name, which he hid in hair, fringe, and clothing. Those hidden Ninas may have been inspired by Snow White's hidden Mickeys. Find one on the three markings on that fawn. There's another, those spots of drying water, and a third on Bashful's chair. Soon every Disney film would contain hidden Mickeys. You didn't need a magnifying glass to find Disney characters in 1938, though. They were everywhere. Kay Kamen was in seventh heaven thanks to the Seven Dwarfs. Collectors were on the hook for eight purchases. February 4, 1938 was launch day for Snow White merchandise. Tie-in products ranged from the expected, dresses, dolls, books, to Snow White-branded hams and bacons. Snow White comics, books, and albums were filled with material cut from the final film. Even Walt started carrying a dopey money clip. You name it, came and sold it. Seeds, corsets, umbrellas, coin banks. A movie ad campaign was a powerful locomotive, able to pull miles and miles of freight that shared the film's branding. There was no downside for Disney. Snow's success was snowballing. Disney branding became contagious. When Walt invested $2,500 of his largesse into a California ski resort, the resort changed the name of its premier slope to Mount Disney. Things were so big, Mickey Mouse got a radio show out of it. The Mickey Mouse Theater of the Air broadcast weekly from the RKO lot on Sundays for the first half of 1938, adapting Disney cartoons. Walt initially voiced Mickey, but soon bowed out due to scheduling issues. Radio star Joe Twerp replaced him. Those performance bonuses that disappeared in 1936 came back in 1938. Many animators got about 3 months' salary at once. The creditors Roy had siphoned money from were in full flush by summer. All except Bank of America. Roy was in so deep with them that RKO sent Disney's checks directly to the bank, which applied it against principal. They did allow Roy to borrow more funds, though. Even with the biggest hit in Hollywood, Disney still owed its soul to the company store. Stardom went to some people's heads. Pinto Colvig, a former Keystone cop who served as the voice of Goofy and Grumpy, ran an ad in January 1938 congratulating Walt on successfully animating his ideas. When Colvig left to make a go of the vaudeville circuit, Goofy lost his gorsh and became a mime. As a parody of this hubris, a Family Circle article had Donald Duck complain that Clark Gable stole the role of Rhett Butler from him. There was a long-standing joke that, after the Three Little Pigs, distributors wanted more pigs. Walt reluctantly bowed to the public demand and made three subsequent pig adventures. Dud, dud, dud. The lesson for him? You can't top pigs with pigs. This also explains why Disney never did sequels in Walt's lifetime. The world said it wanted more dwarfs. But what they really wanted, Walt knew, was another 90 minutes of Disney storytelling. This freed Walt to tell whatever story he wanted, confident that audiences would follow. Walt had cracked the Mickey code, and now the feature code. With great confidence, he had started multiple projects in 1937, timed so they'd be ready once a year. There was Felix Salten's animal novel, Bambi, which MGM had disastrously tried to make in live action. A few months later, Norm Ferguson introduced Walt to a novel about a puppet, Carlo Collodi's Pinocchio. Walt bought the rights to that as well. Bambi would be the follow-up film, then the feature symphony, and Pinocchio maybe fourth. Walt had a thing for European folktales. He'd worked for years trying to adapt stories from Beatrix Potter, Miguel de Cervantes, and Hans Christian Andersen. Armchair philosophers have read plenty into this love of the old world, even the new old world. Pinocchio, for instance, was written 40 years after Oliver Twist. Was this obsession an inferiority complex? A blind spot? Little credence goes to the likeliest answer, that Walt was searching for the best narratives that hadn't been told traditionally. But 1938 turned into a sophomore slump. Walt wanted realistic deer for Bambi, but deer move in either gentle sways or ballistic jolts. Fail to capture those moments and your deer doesn't look real. Another problem was the book's frank depiction of the life cycle. Bambi's life is spent in fear of men who kill his mother and many of his friends. How are they going to portray that without scarring an audience for life? These problems could be solved, but not in time for a 1938 release. Walt had planned for this delay by setting up a parallel animation crew working on Pinocchio. But Pinocchio offered its own problems. The artists had done too good a job animating a wooden puppet. Their main character looked and moved just like a swinging block of pine. No one would care about Pinocchio the way they did about Snow White. The crew just hadn't lived with him long enough to develop a gut feeling. This uncertainty expanded to touch all aspects of production. One animator did 48 pencil tests for a single line of dialogue. Jiminy Cricket looked like a disgusting bug. Walt halted production on Pinocchio 2. It wound up needing an extra $500,000 of work. Mickey did his part to help, but what Disney needed wasn't a mouse, but a guinea pig. Mickey's The Wailers gave animators a taste of drawing a cetacean, key for Pinocchio. Boat Builders gave more experience with water. The pointer in 1939 was changed to make Mickey and Pluto hunters of quail instead of deer. The last thing the studio needed was rumors that Mickey Mouse had killed Bambi's mom. Maybe everyone needed a break. On June 4th, Walt gave the entire studio a day off for a picnic at Lake Norconian, about an hour east of the city. Walt's field day, the invitation said, above a picture of Mickey Mouse in plaid, holding a golf club and teeing up a shot. Believe it or not, this is a day dedicated to the forgetting of sweatboxes, animation footage, and celluloids. It is my sincere wish that you enjoy yourself to the utmost, and that you will find the day one of complete pleasure and relaxation. Walt. To the utmost, indeed. What happened as day turned to night, and the liquor kept flowing, was out of a Roman bacchanal. One rumor involved a horse running down the hallway, another about a respected animator relieving himself from a third-story window, then toppling out. Walt and Lily were introduced to one man's wife, who was drunk, reclined, and nude. Walt, Roy, and their wives apparently left the party in shame. Pinocchio went through several more looks, but they all shared the same troubling marionette joints and carpenter shim hands. The solution, it turned out, was not to change his look, but his movement. Credit for this goes to Milt Call, who got his start with Mickey. Pinocchio wanted to be a real boy, so despite his wooden build, he should be animated as if he already were. The audience would believe in him just as much as they believed in a 3-foot mouse. You can always draw the wooden joints and make him a wooden puppet afterwards, Call explained. It worked. But what to do with those roof shingles for hands? A pair of bulbous white 4-fingered gloves went over each, bridging the span between toy and boy. To solve the problem of the main character being too dull, Pinocchio was surrounded with outrageous comic relief, including boys who turn into jackasses. The Jiminy Cricket designs clicked when animators decided Jiminy would look nothing at all like a cricket. Every problem Walt had with Pinocchio was solved with a solution from Mickey Mouse. Mickeying things up wouldn't work for the sober Bambi, though, which necessitated realistic animals. Thumper the Rabbit could not become Oswald. Walt sent some animators to Maine to photograph the woods. Mainers heard about this and sent Walt 2 live deer to live at the studio. They were named Bambi and Feline. The studio stable now consisted of wallabies, rabbits, ducks, owls, deer, and even a skunk. To avoid distraction from the studio zoo, in more ways than one, Roy rented Team Bambi, a building that would become the Grand Central Station of Animation, 861 North Seward Street in Hollywood. The code phrase used when Walt came to visit was, "Man is in the forest." Even without distractions, it still took up to an hour and a half to draw a single frame of Bambi, whose long legs could never stretch or squash. Animating without exaggeration is as hard as winning a race without bending your knees. Bambi was unbending work. No two ways about it. Walt decided to fix the Bambi problem by steering into it. Bambi would be stiff, but all the other characters would be cartoony. "Everything should be done through Bambi," Walt said during an early story conference. "I would hate to see any of the other characters too straight. You would want that in Bambi's mother. You would want Bambi more or less straight in a way. Everyone else would be comic relief. Bambi would become the upright axle around which everything turned." Once again, the solution came from mining Mickey. Mouse blood now ran through the veins of all 3 Disney features. In a very real way, all Disney characters are updated versions of Mickey Mouse. He is the untastable umami that separates Disney cartoons from seemingly identical but inferior alternatives. Whoever could make the world fall in love with a rodent surely could make a princess dance or an elephant fly. These developments were compliments to Mickey, but they were also fatal. If all the mouse's strengths were being recycled, what was left for his own cartoons? Already he was a featured player in his own shorts, second fiddle to Donald and Goofy and Pluto, and sometimes even Clarabelle. If his storytelling secrets were parceled out to everyone else, the only thing left would be a rat boy. Mickey was dying, and Walt knew it. Around this time, he said he felt caught in a trap with a good mouse. They could spend Mickey's absence for a few months. Look magazine said he was chivalrously staying out of the spotlight so as not to upstage his good friend Snow White. But Disney without Mickey was Troy without Achilles. "Walt wanted to give Mick a kick in the ass," recalled animator Jack Kinney. He was afraid he was becoming too much of a Boy Scout, hence Mickey's meaty role as Jack the Giant Slayer in The Brave Little Tailor. He was heroic, Doug Fairbanks again after so many years of Bing Crosby. He also, for the moment, was tailless, which animators thought might save time. Forced to fell a colossus, Mickey finds a way to do so using nothing but his sewing skills. Art saves the day. Walt, like Mickey, was being celebrated for his artistry. In 1938, the University of Southern California awarded him an honorary Master of Sciences. Yale and Harvard added a pair of honorary Masters of Arts. Like many high school dropouts, Walt put education on a pedestal. Years later, he would even help found an arts college, California Institute of the Arts, which has produced more Pixar animators than Italy has produced priests. All those desks and classrooms would have been much appreciated at Walt Disney Studios back in 1938. Hyperion Avenue now resembled the overrun house in Mickey's Nightmare. The main building had tangled annexes. There were bungalows across the street. Some extra locations were miles away. The poor messenger boy, Card Walker, was stuck running all over town. Snow White's green allowed Disney to finally build a new studio. Walt and Roy realized the studio had to allow for multiple concurrent projects, plus room to build. It also needed its own water source since wells were needed in those days for the air conditioning. Everything was designed for the comfort of the Disney animators, Disney biographer Bob Thomas reported. Walt arranged for new animators, tables, and new chairs, going so far as to dissemble a chair to ensure it offered support. There were sports fields, a subsidized restaurant, a gym, a lounge, a sunroom. Every single room had a window. Instead of a sweatbox, a luxurious screening room. The 10 buildings were connected via underground tunnels. Keeping them unconnected above ground made them earthquake resistant. Work would be nicer than home. Over the years, the residents would cozy it up with their own nicknames. An accountancy office beneath the animation building was nicknamed the Mole Hole. An art storage room was called the Morgue. A spot where all the ink girls strolled past on the way to lunch was called Seal Rock. The whole place was called the House of Mouse. Walt's office suite would become one of the world's most well-known workplaces. Walt hosted weekly TV shows from it, took meetings there, and mapped out 20 years of corporate expansion. It had a shower, a series of inboxes for a dozen different types of paperwork, a storage space for trophies, and a two-layered credenza to keep multiple projects on the front burner. His two administrative assistants were nicknamed the Secretaries of the Interior and the Exterior. A replica is on display in Orlando, just as Julia Child's kitchen is in the Smithsonian. Before you move, you get your house in order. Roy decided to consolidate the corporate structure, folding the real estate licensing and film recording branches into Walt Disney Productions. Roy and Edna got 30,000 shares each, Walt and Lily 45,000 shares each. The wives were one share away from a takeover. Roy found his new studio space 6 miles away from Hyperion Avenue in the San Fernando Valley town of Burbank. Warner Brothers was already there, and Columbia used Burbank's wilderness to film westerns. Roy secured $3 million of financing for the complex. Disney coming to town helped Burbank earn its reputation as the media capital of the world. Everything from The Tonight Show to Nickelodeon slime fests to a preponderance of the world's adult films is filmed in the valley. The studio was designed with two main thoroughfares. For a behind-the-scenes film made in 1941, prop masters built a street sign naming them Mickey Avenue and Dopey Drive. The signs were so good, they were never taken down. It's become as iconic a SoCal intersection as Hollywood and Vine. Walt fell in love with the world of construction. Dozens of his films, from Oswald's Skyscrapers to Mickey's Building a Building, prominently feature architecture. He spent years imagining the perfect workplace in his head, its form, function, and features. Walt still dreamt about entertainment, but now thought about it via the frozen music of structures. That structure's base was shaky, though, in a way that was not the San Andreas fault. Disney needed huge hits to stay afloat. Nothing else would do. And the 1938 short, Boat Builders, Mickey, Donald, and Goofy send away for a kit to build a gigantic vessel. Minnie's simple act of christening it with a bottle causes the ship to shudder and implode, leaving Mickey and company all wet. That was Disney, a weak-hulled hulk. Empires around the world were just as wobbly, as Walt realized when he visited Italy for the Venice Film Festival. Snow White was up against Olympia, a Leni Riefenstahl documentary about the Berlin Olympic Games. International politics demanded that Snow White not win any regular awards, since America's ally Britain was on tenterhooks both with Italy and Germany. But the festival would be a laughingstock if it excluded Snow White for being anti-German. It was a German fairy tale. The film festival compromised. It gave Olympia the Mussolini Cup, but produced an unjuried one-off award to Snow White called the Grand Art Trophy. Peace was maintained. Roy stayed in Europe several months, supervising the dubbing and release of Snow White into seemingly every language but German. He did visit Germany, trying to at least get paid for past sales. Berlin, he said, was decked out with Nazi banners and posters, as if the entire city was premiering a film. Nazis were then seen by some as passionate counterculture revolutionaries. They definitely knew brand awareness. Walt was even more neophytic about the Nazis. Mr. A. Hitler, the Nazi old thing, says Mickey's silly. Imagine that, Walt wrote in 1933. Well, Mickey is going to save Mr. A. Hitler from drowning or something someday. Just wait and see if he doesn't. Then won't Mr. A. Hitler be ashamed? Also in 1933, Mickey Mouse claimed to be fans of both Hitler and Joseph Stalin because the unrest in the world threatens my sales. Back in the States, Walt grew worried that his parents were too far away. What if something happened? So he and Roy moved Mom and Pop to Hollywood and bought them a house. Walt even recorded a car commercial in exchange for a free DeSoto, which he gave them. It was no more than balancing the scales for Elias Disney bankrolling their sons in the lean years. Their new house had a faulty furnace. Facilities men from the studio couldn't fix it, and Walt's mother, Flora, fretted about it for a month. One night, the house began filling up with carbon monoxide gas. In the morning, Flora collapsed from the fumes. Elias found her and tried to pull her to safety, but he passed out too. Their housekeeper almost succumbed as well, but ran to get a neighbor. They pulled the couple out, but Flora had died. The sons were devastated. The house they chose for their parents was a death trap. It had killed their mother. Walt could never talk about the incident. He pushed it down. But the loss bled through. Armchair analysts have made much hay over the years about why all Disney characters were orphans. Here was why. Chapter 31. Deerstalker, 1939. For Disney, 1938 was supposed to be the year of Bambi, but it came and went without a feature. So would 1939. It turned out that an animated film required 2 years of prep work, and then a third for the actual animation. If you wanted to watch a Disney feature in 1939, it would be an old print of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Or not. In May 1939, Roy had RKO pull Snow White from distribution. Snow was going into a deep sleep, one caused not by the evil queen, but economic theory. Roy felt that audiences would continue to pay new release prices for an older movie, provided that movie was out of circulation. It was a smart move, the beginning of the heralded Disney Vault. Shoddy prints playing at third-run 5-cent theaters would bring in very little new money, but corking the supply could build up demand. Old Mickey Mouses were still being rented, right? Keeping Snow White out of Nickelodeon's might let Disney show it again for a quarter. Audiences hadn't forgotten Snow. She was still winning awards, in fact. At the 1939 Academy Awards, Walt took home 8 Oscars, 1 honorary award for producing Snow White, and 7 dwarf-sized acolytes. Walt was tense at the ceremony despite being the only guaranteed winner, still unsure how to act around famous people.
"Don't be nervous, Mr. Disney,"
Shirley Temple told him while presenting him his octet. In 1939, Disney would produce 15 shorts, half what it produced in an earlier era. They were all the expense of a feature, but for a fraction of the profits. "You spend a hell of a lot of money, and what have you got?" Walt questioned. Fewer shorts, though, meant less Mickey. In the past 3 years, Mickey had gone from being in 64% of the yearly shorts to 28% of them. Viewers in 1939 saw twice as many Donald Ducks as Mickeys. They even saw Donald outside of Disney. The RKO comedy Bachelor Mother took place in a department store littered with Donald Duck toys, but no Mickeys. One of the Mickey shorts that year was paid for by Nabisco, which had a booth at the World's Fair. It's not subtle. Mickey saves the day from Minnie's bad cooking by bringing home Oreos, Fig Newtons, and a milk bone for Pluto. At the same World's Fair, a Mickey Mouse watch was buried in a time capsule. The very first time capsule was in Georgia in 1936. Mickey went into that one, too. Burying the mouse seemed ominous. Disney's previous experience with stars past their prime was to forget them and, to quote Walt himself, keep moving forward. No one clamored for Julius or Alice, not even for the Three Little Pigs. Mickey and Minnie were different, though. They were still beloved. Good money was paid for another ad featuring 2 minutes of Mickey and others, carrying banners for Standard Oil. But they were shills, not stars. The river of progress had sucked away the silence, the black and whites, the Alices, the Oswalds. It had ripped Walt's friends and his co-workers from his hands, slammed others onto the rocks of reality. It had killed his mother. What was all his power for if he didn't fight back, if he couldn't pull someone from its currents? Walt would not resign Mickey Mouse to the same fate as the statue of Ozymandias. The mouse was more than a cash cow or metonym. He was a symbol for hope itself. And to keep hope alive, Walt would change the course of history. He would save Mickey by putting him in the single greatest cartoon ever made. It would be tough. Walt knew better than anyone that Mickey had his limitations. That falsetto, for instance. Solution? No talking. There would be music, but no dialogue. A callback to the earliest silly symphonies. No sound effects either, to better emphasize the pantomime and the score. Another problem. Mickey was the least interesting person in any room. Solution? Make him the only person in the room. No Donald, no Goofy, no Minnie, no Pluto. That introduced a new problem. Not for nothing is Just Mickey considered a terrible cartoon. The mouse needed a supporting cast that would not sweep up his spotlight. The solution came via the classic fable of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. The plot hit all the marks Walt needed and would allow for the special effects team to have a field day with water and lighting effects. There was a push to make Dopey the main character. You can see remnants of it in Mickey's oversized clothes and silence. But Walt was insistent. This was Mickey's role. For this story, Fred Moore designed a new Mickey with eyeballs. Mickey's expressive irises helped sell subtle frame-by-frame emotional shifts. Audiences first saw this new Mickey in the 1939 hunting cartoon, The Pointer. The price for The Sorcerer's Apprentice spiraled to $125,000, making it more expensive than Disney's previous budget-buster short, Brave Little Taylor. A cheapo house like I worked could crank out a year's worth of animation for that sum. What that moolah bought was time to dwell on each decision. Almost every shot of its 9 minutes was rotoscoped, to convey the importance of color, red robes, blue hat, yellow straw. The storyboards were painted. Color was, in fact, a character. When Mickey's glum, for instance, the film drops to gray on gray. The shadows, the water, the scope,
Rarely had so much money been put on screen this ostentatiously. If The Sorcerer's Apprentice was released as a regular short, Walt would take a bath worse than Mickey did in the picture. To make its money back, it would have to be part of an anthology. They were becoming popular. Grand Hotel had nabbed the Best Picture Oscar. The natural solution seemed to be casting Mickey Mouse as the film's host, a perfect fit for the ringmaster rodent. But the MC can't also be the main event. A concert needed a music director. Enter conductor Leopold Stokowski. Stokowski was an acquaintance of Walt's, and had said he was up for working with Disney in any capacity. Elitists criticized Walt for vulgarizing classical music with his cartoons. A European conductor would class up Dopey Drive. Mickey's famous on-screen moment of shaking hands with Stokowski was when, to quote art historian Robert Hughes, high art and low art collapsed into one another. Stokowski, who experimented with Bell Labs' high-fidelity sound equipment earlier in the decade, fell in love with the sophisticated recording facilities Disney offered. Walt had spent $400,000 on a system called Fantasound, with multiple microphones set up at the Philadelphia Academy of Music. A dozen tracks of audio-reeled sounds were recorded, each mapped to a different speaker. Stokowski had perfect control over each take from each section. Faster, slower, stop, do it like last time. The dials and knobs of the control board put a baton to shame. This is the ultimate in conducting, he said, the first to wear the sorcerer's hat of music producer. Stokowski had such a good experience, he started to suggest other pieces he could record for Walt. You could never tell if Walt was joking or not when he displayed rustic ignorance. He claimed to have never heard of Beethoven. And when Stokowski suggested Wagner, Walt said, well, let's hire him. The eight movements of what was dubbed the concert feature slowly cohered in Walt's head. Stokowski's soundboard and reams of three-hole punched papers of animators' desks. Deems Taylor of the famed Algonquin Roundtable in New York City was picked as host. Walt envisioned the concert feature as a yearly event, adding one new short each year. Maybe one day Mickey could even claim the hosting gig, if The Sorcerer's Apprentice cycled out. Speaking of new hosts, the Burbank Complex on Buena Vista Street was finished in 1939. Disney announced its opening by calling it a birthday present for Mickey Mouse, who was 11. Roy's press release about moving in didn't get much play since Disney invaded Burbank the same day Germany invaded Poland. The first two employees in the new studio were a pair of cameramen. Bit by bit, animators, crew, and staff were transferred. The process took not days or weeks, but years. Entire buildings were disassembled, carted the 6 miles to Burbank, and rebuilt. Each day brought Roy one step closer to not paying double taxes and double rent. Many a joke was made about the hegira dubbed Disney's Moving Day, since Moving Day was also the title of a 1936 Mickey short. That short was about Mickey being evicted because he was 6 months behind on rent. The antics were hilarious, but the premise was pure depression, and close to the truth about Disney's skin-of-the-teeth fiscal health. In headier times, Walt had promised $1 million of bonuses from Snow White profits. That money instead went to Pinocchio. 2 years after the biggest movie of the decade, Disney ended 1939 with a quarterly loss. Years later, Roy told Floyd Godfredson that without the Mickey newspaper strip income, Disney would have declared bankruptcy. Eventually, one and all disembarked to the new studio. They all ate in the same cafeteria where Walt stood in line and paid just like anyone else. Some were upset that employees had to pay 20 cents for a decent parking spot. But then they saw Roy Disney dropped off by Edna every morning. The chief executive officer of Disney couldn't afford his own car. Walt didn't dole out privileges to his junior staff because he didn't dole them out, period. Everyone at Disney rowed the oars together. One big family. At least, that was how Walt viewed things. If Roy was man enough to look up to his little brother, why couldn't everyone else follow suit? Snow White wouldn't have been possible with a staff out for a paycheck. Disney was a special place with special rules, and it was built on a foundation of reverence, both for the work and the man who ran the show. While the rest of the world worshipped the mouse, those who made the mouse looked to Father Walt. A biography called Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince, claimed that in 1940 Walt became a spy for the FBI. There's no evidence for this claim, and the book does not present any. As with the rumors of cryogenic freezing, it's part of the Disney mythos. Anyone can add to the legend if they make their mark dark enough. But the rumor speaks to the chaos that would envelop the wartime Disney studio. Over the next few years, Walt's spirit would be wounded in the same way his back was after that polo injury, which never properly healed. Lily suggested the back injury may have predated polo by decades, the result of carrying newspapers in middle school through the Kansas City snow. Walt seemed to be missing a piece of himself. All his efforts seemed to be attempts to get back to the halcyon days of yesteryear. His personal wartime crisis of faith still reverberates through the world via his forever changed alter ego. As bad as Walt would feel during this period, it could have been worse. Imagine Walt's reaction if he knew the real truth about his studio. He was not a spy, no, but there was a foreign spy at Disney during the war. Walt unknowingly invited him in to stroll along Dopey Drive, where he snooped around everyone's projects and reported back to headquarters. This spy worked for the 20th century's most infamous espionage ring, and he was never caught. The fate of the world may have been determined by what he learned, and Walt would go to his grave not knowing who had betrayed him and betrayed America. He never smelled the rat. Part 5. Enemies, 1940 through 1945. When mice grow up, they don't ever have to go to war and fight against other mice. Roald Dahl, The Witches. Chapter 32. Prodigal, 1940. Walt Disney was never satisfied. When he was mired in failure, he wanted to make a living. When he made a living, he wanted success. When he had success, he risked everything for triumph. And now that he had triumph, he wanted it all the time. Over 1,200 employees had hitched their wagon to his star. But how could they ever improve upon Snow White, the most beloved film ever made? The ultimate answer was found in a pile of garbage. The pile had empty soda bottles, greasy paper plates, balled-up napkins, apple cores, chicken bones, and an insectile halo of bees. And it wasn't just one pile. Every garbage can Walt saw was overflowing this way. The slovenliness led to people just throwing their hot dog tinfoil and cotton candy sticks on the ground. Walt was at an amusement park that looked and smelled like a city dump. He often took his daughters out for weekend day trips and was appalled by the refuse. But cleaning up the joint was just one challenge. There was so much more to fix. The rides were old, run down, and possibly unsafe. The carnies were hostile. Everyone was trying to rip you off. No one focused on making the customers smile. In later years, he would indeed do something about this. For now, though, he griped. Every other animation honcho in town was griping as well. They had to compete with Walt. Disney's profits were welded to its animation budget, and no one could keep up with the ballooning overhead. Disney was a command economy, and whatever Walt decided as his next endeavor would bankrupt another animation studio. A lot of those soon-to-be elephant graveyards were local to Los Angeles, not just Iwerks Studio, but Columbia, Charles Mintz's Crazy Cat Studio, and Van Buren. Walt had set up his company like a family, his family, where you earned peanuts until you got fed up and left. For the diaspora who left, it was only a matter of time before their new studio went bust or they grew tired of the dog-eat-dog world. They would boomerang back to Disney. True artists, after all, would rather make something great then get a competitive salary. If you were truly irreplaceable, what made staying worth your while? Norm Ferguson at one point made $300 a week, as much as Walt himself. He stayed for nearly 30 years. The twin granddaddies of this philosophy were when everyone but Ub Iwerks left Disney in 1928, and then when Iwerks left a year later. Both events were like losing a limb, yet the company kept going. No one other than Walt, it seemed, was essential. It was Detroit-style cartooning, and one of the reasons why Henry Ford had become chummy with Walt. Whoever wanted to could leave. Walt would replace them with a cheaper man who'd work longer hours. Disney's motto seemed to be, "I don't need you. I don't need anyone." Not even Mickey was safe from his brutal meritocracy. Mickey Mouse starred in only 3 shorts in 1940, not counting the concert feature, which has been renamed Fantasia. The continued popularity of Mickey merchandise may have helped keep him off screen. Sales stayed up despite his absence, so there seemed no downside in not making Mickey films. Or maybe the Sorcerer's Apprentice budget made staffers think a Mickey could only be made with a skyscraper of a budget. To allay this concern, Walt wrote a May memo detailing how a 70-minute Mickey and the Beanstalk film could be made for $350,000. That was 3 times cheaper per minute than The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Mickey and the Beanstalk was meant to resurrect the Mickey brand. One story man came up with a series of hysterical gags that had Walt bent double with laughter. He pitched naughty moments such as green beans that disrobed like strippers, and outrageous moments where a ravenous Donald started eating both Mickey and Goofy. It was closer to Looney Tunes than anything Disney had ever done. When he was done laughing, Walt turned down the script. "It was funny as hell," he began, "but you have murdered my characters. You have destroyed with this one film, if I made it, what I've been working years to build up." There would be no fiddling with Mickey, in other words. He would keep going as he always had, or he wouldn't show up at all. Disney was more than a studio now, it was a company. Roy is given the acclaim for this accomplishment, but it belongs to Walt. Walt turned his last name into a synonym for a certain type of entertainment, suitable for the whole family, a bit nostalgic, and with a modicum of sass. As a later slogan said, "Kid tested, mother approved." Walt tried to know all his hundreds of employees, if only by sight. He didn't work with them the way he used to, but he valued their work. At night he would tour his daughters around, sometimes dig through the trash to ensure animators didn't throw away their freshest stuff. He gave everyone a respectful cough before entering a room. He even was fine with them taking long breaks. "I don't care if you're loafing. Don't let me catch you jumping back to your desks." All that mattered was the work. He fired one employee whose finished work turned out to be a Kansas City bankroll of one drawing on top of a blank pile. After 3 years of waiting, the public received cartoon bookends in 1940. Pinocchio was in February. It was supposed to be a Christmas 1939 release, but doing things the Disney way made that an impossibility. Fantasia arrived at year's end. Walt was so hubristic about bringing 2 features to the screen, he didn't even bother submitting any shorts to the Oscars that year. It broke what otherwise would have been close to a 20-year continuous nomination streak. "I'd rather have an artistic flop than a box office smash hit any day," Walt said, not knocking on wood. That 1-2 punch was returned in kind to Disney Studios by the half-hearted public. While Snow White pulled in $8.5 million its first year, Pinocchio, which had cost almost twice as much, ended 1940 with a smidge over $1 million in ticket sales. Reviews were quite good, it won 2 Oscars, and historians call it Disney's finest effort, but it was a 7-digit loss. Fantasia was worse. Walt wanted audiences to really get their and his money's worth, so he arranged for high-end theaters, some of which didn't show films, to show it. Many were outfitted with a $30,000 Fantasound speaker system to play the audio the way he intended. He charged reserved seat road show pricing, usually done for epics like Gone with the Wind. He gambled that families would pay more for a better experience. They did not. Parents were used to discount child admissions, not a premium fare for a cartoon. The reduced locations meant that for every one theater in New York that held Fantasia for a year, there were 100 others who never ran it. RKO would eventually take scissors to Fantasia, cutting 40 minutes so it could be part of a double bill. Some families were scared of the satanic demon, Chernabog, from the Night on Bald Mountain segment. The everyman thought it too highbrow, and the elite too lowbrow. The New York Herald Tribune reviewer, overreaching just a tad, wrote, "All I could think to say of the experience as I staggered out was that it was Nazi." The Nazis were justifiably on the world's mind then, but criticizing or even simply describing Nazi actions would get you branded a rabble-rousing communist by those who wanted America to stay out of a second worldwide bloodbath. The German-American Bund infamously sued Warner Brothers in 1939 for $500,000 for releasing an anti-Nazi film. Anti-Nazi sentiment branded you a commie. A politician once railed against 11-year-old Shirley Temple for her pinko tendencies. But it was only a matter of time before America, too, was sucked into what Time magazine had just dubbed World War II. However else it shaped the world, it would be bad for business. Walt had expected the usual 45% of Disney incomes to come from the foreign markets, but they were preoccupied right now. He couldn't even install Fantasound anymore. The metal was all going to munitions and vehicles for our allies. Welcome bienvenue. Welcome to war rationing. Disney biographers Catherine and Richard Green have pointed out the irony of Disney making its fortune during the Great Depression, when even the movie studios were on the financial ropes, and then walking the macabre line of bankruptcy during the economic recovery of the war years. Now it was 1940, the starting gate for the worst decade of the 20th century, one that would destroy entire economies, countries, and peoples. So too for Disney, 1940 was a bad year, but it was only the beginning. Roy was acutely aware of how his family company had gone from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in 3 years. After he assessed the damages, he brought Walt in for a dressing down. Fantasia and Pinocchio were flops. There was no money in shorts anymore. There were lawsuits over Snow White's money. The singing voices of Snow and the Prince said they were due a cut of the soundtrack profits. They were not. Gunther Lessing's contract was ironclad. Europe was on fire. The Disneys owed the banks $4.5 million. Costs had escalated, and their profits were falling like a cowpat. Simply breaking even would be a miracle. Instead of disagreeing with Roy's assessment, Walt chose to reminisce about how far they'd come. Why, back in the day they couldn't get a loan for $10,000. Now they were on the hook for millions. Normally this story gets told to showcase Walt's optimism, but their situation was dire. If all 132 million census-counted Americans of 1940 plunked down a quarter to watch a Disney movie, Disney would still be in debt. When both shorts and features were unprofitable, what was left to do? Long-term experiments such as the Disney Vault would have to wait. A year after Snow White's deep freezing, Roy scheduled the Walt Disney Festival of Hits, 4 recent shorts plus Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. For this, audiences were asked to pay as much as a new release. They did. Roy was right. Disney also started a relationship with Dell, which put Donald Duck in the 4th issue of a comic book called Four Color. This led to Dell spotlighting Mickey Mouse, his own monthly comic. Over the years that Mickey comic has jumped more ships than Blackbeard, going from Dell to Gold Key to Whitman to Gladstone to Gemstone to Boom. Yes, Boom, with an exclamation point. Disney owns Marvel Comics now, so expect the comic now called Mickey Mouse and Friends to move publishers again. But re-releases and licenses wouldn't be enough. Roy knew there was only one road out of this labyrinth, and it was called Wall Street. Going public would bring in enough money to pay back the bank. Senior employees would be given shares of the company, so their loyalty would pay true dividends. but it would be a hard step for Walt to take. When asked in 1938 why he was successful, he said, "We don't have to make profits for stockholders. New York investors can't